So, yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge Josh and Pam Doty, who helped me put together these slides. All right, so I think one of the biggest things we have to sort of focus on, and I think Josh and Charlene have sort of raised this a lot, is the extent to which Medicaid, you know, shapes a lot of the service delivery system, and just to remember that it is a state-level program. So to a huge extent, the states are determining what's happening within the long-term care service system. And, you know, just to remind people, you know, Medicaid is within a federal context, but the states really set things. If you remember the Supreme Court decision about the ACA, everything was constitutional except for the part where the ACA tried to tell the states what to do with the Medicaid program. So just to sort of really emphasize that component of things. So we all know that nursing home is a mandated benefit. So the movement away from nursing homes as the default site of care has really been different based on which state you're in. So there's been also a public policy goal of preventing Medicare from becoming a source of long-term care. So the federal government has made you know, various steps over the years to try to rein in the Medicare, particularly the home health benefit, whenever it appeared to be becoming more of a source of long-term care. And not always successfully, because what happened was you'd have some kind of policy change, and then you know the Medicare home health benefit would go down, and then it would go back up again because people would figure out some kind of way of getting more money out of that particular benefit. And one of the things, you know, that's also on the horizon, once again, with the Medicare home health benefit is something called the Jimmo decision, which was a Supreme Court decision that basically changed the basis of eligibility for the home health benefit, once again sort of creating some space for it to become more of a long-term benefit. And it's, I don't know, maybe Josh will be able to talk about it. I don't know if you have any evidence on whether that's actually materializing or not. But people in the long-term care field are really looking out to see whether this is going to change things to any great extent. Some people think it's going to have a big impact. Some people think it's not so much. So that's something to look out for. And Courtney's presentation earlier also talked a lot about the VA's role in the long-term care delivery system. So that's something that's also not to be forgotten and underestimated. Okay. So really, states are the drivers of long-term care policy. And as such, some states have been much more successful in moving away from nursing homes as a default site of care. But there has been a federal public policy goal of what's called rebalancing. So rebalancing means creating the correct balance between institutional care and non-institutional care. This movement has been more extreme, as Josh pointed out, you know, where you've seen the movement of dollars has really been among certain groups of younger people with disabilities, people with intellectual disabilities, and so forth. So that movement hasn't been as extreme for people who are older. But, you know, one of the really, you could call this a success, given all the dismal news that Charlene and Josh presented. The fact is that the nursing home population in the United States actually has decreased. You could point that as a success because not as many people are using nursing homes. And they're moving into different types of service delivery environments. One of the big initiatives in the Medicaid program has been in promoting more consumer-directed care or participant-directed care. It goes under a number of different names, which are programs where instead of people being given direct services, they're being given a budget. I know in Britain there's been this movement toward personal budgets. So it's a similar sort of movement. It's expanded fairly broadly. I think 23 states now have some kind of participant-directed program. Once again, you know, these programs are not necessarily something that a lot of people have access to, even if it exists in their state. So, you know, it's we need to be careful about emphasizing how wonderful that is. So another sort of big change, which I'm going to go into a little bit more near the end of the presentation, has to do with a shift to managed care. and integrated care environments for pulling together long-term care and acute and other kinds of care. Okay, so the biggest change has been this proliferation of nursing home alternatives, which is why Charlene's points at the later part of her conversation about the lack of quality controls are so critically important, because we have this expanding component of our delivery system that we really know very little about. We don't know what the correct approach to regulating them is, and that regulation really varies enormously by state. And we have no data about what's actually going on in these environments. So we have all these people being shifted into these different environments, and we don't really know what's happening. So data sources estimate the number of elderly in these non-nursing home settings as between, you know, nearly a million and 2 million. So one of the big questions, I think, from a public policy perspective is, are wealthier people switching to assisted living environments as their primary source of long-term care, residential long-term care? And are nursing homes therefore becoming default options for poor people? So there's a question about nursing home quality is tied to the proportion of people who are Medicaid recipients. So that has an impact, really, on the quality of nursing homes, which, as we know, is not wonderful. So, So here's a sort of chart from the Medicare data looking at where people are based on what kind of services they get. So it's basically the same story. It's showing that the nursing home proportion is still pretty small. All right, so residential care facilities are predominantly private pay, a smaller proportion of them are on Medicaid, whereas a pretty high proportion of people in nursing facilities are on Medicaid. So the bottom line is people who are poor enough for Medicaid cannot afford the cost of room and board, even if Medicaid covers the cost of services in alternative settings. So once again, that goes to the point about, you know, where rich people, relatively well-off people are versus poor people. So one of the big issues is this shift toward alternative service delivery settings placing pressure on nursing homes to improve? You would like to think that there's, that nursing homes are going to realize nobody wants to go to them, they've got such a bad public rep, you know, maybe we need to change. And in fact, there is something called the Pioneer Movement, Pioneer Network, and the Culture Change Movement, where and it's been supported by public policy to try to encourage nursing homes to take a different approach to how they deliver services. And this has been really encouraged, and it includes a variety of components, such as changed physical environment, changed approach to service delivery. In many cases, it includes a component that addresses workforce issues by trying to humanize the work environment for lower level, CNA staff, which are basically the people who do most of the unskilled labor in nursing homes, trying to include them as part of the work team and so forth and so on. So the culture change movement really is ideally a top-to-bottom approach to delivering services in nursing homes in a different sort of way. So this has become quite popular. Who knows the extent to which it really is changing what's going on. But certainly in terms of a buzzword, nursing homes are adopting that as something they know it's desirable. So once again, going back to this point about the shift away from nursing homes, it is very state specific. So I have some numbers here about spending on home and community-based services as opposed to nursing homes. You can see in Texas it's very low, in New York. I mean, obviously there are the averages in terms of expenditures in these states is just very different anyway, even if you didn't look at the differences between nursing homes and home and community-based services. But you can see how extreme those differences. And then the other thing that people actually look at quite a lot is what proportion of overall long-term care expenditures goes toward nursing homes versus home and community-based services. Once again, you can see a pretty extreme variation there. And, you know, just generally speaking, there's extreme variation in terms of eligibility. It can go down to the county level, not just state level, but things can really vary enormously by where you live in the state. And another measure of access has to do with waiting lists. Okay. So one of the big issues with states in the U.S. is that they operate on balanced budgets. The federal government can borrow money from year to year. So if your budget, if you don't have enough money to pay for stuff in one year, you can borrow it from next year. States cannot do that. So this is, states are very careful about expanding their Medicaid programs because they're really worried about that year when they don't have enough money coming in. And when is that? It's during recessions and times when people are actually in greater need of services, right? So, you know, there's this big conundrum in America about social welfare services that are funded by state budgets and a constant incentive for states to keep that kind of spending down. All right, so I have to very quickly go through coordinated care. This is a big movement right now because the federal government encouraged it under the ACA, the healthcare reform bill, and included a lot of provisions to encourage integrated care. So they developed a federal office of coordinated care and promoted a number of, put a lot of money into a number of demonstration projects to allow states to experiment with different coordinated care models. So the reasons behind this is that we have the Medicaid program and we have the Medicare program, and there are a lot of incentives to shift costs from one to the other. And this really matters because the people who are eligible for both the Medicare and the Medicaid program, once again, Medicaid is for very poor people, Medicare is for older and disabled individuals, they are the most expensive population. So if you're going to focus on trying to keep down costs in public programs, you're really going to focus on the dually eligible population. So the integrated care programs are really a targeted way for the federal government and state governments to try to keep down costs for that population. So the idea is if you pool all that money together in one bucket and make somebody at risk for all those costs, there's no longer going to be this incentive to do inefficient things by shifting costs. So there is a lot of evidence of cost shifting and of inefficient choices, and this slide is about avoidable hospitalizations among nursing home residents, because sometimes nursing homes, which are reimbursed by Medicaid predominantly, admit people to hospitals because then they're in the Medicare program. They don't have to pay for the care of a person and the health issues. So there has been evidence that this cost shift, this split, creates inefficiencies, and the number of potential hospitalizations is one of those pieces of evidence. So there's a lot of support for that. All right, so the ACA encourages integrated care models to address this, and there are a number of states that have gone for this. But interestingly enough, a lot of states applied for the grants, and then a lot of states dropped out. And one of the issues around integrated care is what you're doing is you're asking an insurer to pull together two different systems of care, the long-term care system, which is, community-based providers, a whole different sort of provider mentality and organization, and the acute healthcare system. And, you know, insurers in the U.S. who have been attracted to this have tended to be commercial insurers who don't have experience with those providers, those networks, those ways of providing care. So historically, there hasn't been a huge amount of success with a lot of the coordinated care initiatives that have been in place. The ones that have been successful have tended to be led by not-for-profit organizations such as PACE or, in Massachusetts, we have something called the Community Care Alliance, although there are some commercial insurers who seem to be making a success of it. We don't know what's going to happen with these coordinated care initiatives. People have been very optimistic about it. Skeptics are concerned about the fact that so much hope is being put into these things when there's very little evidence that the commercial insurers who are doing this sort of thing have ever been successful or have the ability to do so. Luckily, the ACA is throwing a lot of money at this, and they've included evaluation components in it and requirements to collect data. So there should be, hopefully, some good evidence coming out of these experiments about whether, in fact, this model can work or not. So, okay. So these are the concerns. Will it over-medicalize long-term care? Will people lose choice of providers? All sorts of problems associated with this kind of coordinated care. But I have to stop now. Okay, great. Oops. All right.
Thanks, Pam. So why don't you stay there? Joanne, you want to come up? So we're now open for questions, comments, visa applications.
I think you've sold it very well. I was surprised by the picture you were making of the quality of nursing care homes, and I was trying to understand why. Is this that really the quality is that bad, or you've got more information about potential problems, or is it that the people that are in those institutions are just very, very dependent and therefore at high risk of those things happening? Because it seems to me that relative to other countries, you've got, and even with problems, you've got the national minimum data set that gives you information about every provider you've got. You're suggesting that every provider would get inspected on a yearly basis, yes. Which is more than, for example, we could do in England. Right. So what's happening there?
Well, we have a highly privatized system. 70% of the nursing homes are for profit, and the chains, over half of them are chains now. They're interested in profits, they have high administrative costs, and they cut the labor costs enormously. So you only see, a very small group that has high quality, and they tend to be the nonprofits and the government facilities, and it's very hard to get into those nursing homes because they don't want to take the Medicaid, the poor people, because the rates are low. So these commercial groups are willing to take Medicaid with low payments, but they cut their costs below these payment levels and deliver very bad care.
So I think you've really identified an important issue. I think we have the best regulatory system in the world. It just doesn't necessarily produce the best quality of care. And I think Charlene sort of identified one of the issues. There's been so much effort on sort of gathering the data and setting the quality measures that there has been less attention to the enforcement side and the monitoring or making sure that the data that's reported is accurate. And, CMS is busy contracting with my organization to produce more quality measures, but they're not paying attention to the enforcement aspect. I think that's an important part of it.
I also wanted to, I had a thought about, Charlene's presentation. What are the quality measures come from these assessments that are also used to set payment levels. That's another thing to sort of factor into it. Because we're risk adjusting payment, the OASIS, for example, the same assessment tool that's being used to assess people, on their outcomes is also being used to determine payment levels. So there's almost an inherent incentive to overemphasize acuity. Anyway.
Yeah, and I think we do a better, we try to regulate the quality, but we do a very poor job of regulating the financial accountability. There's almost nothing on financial accountability, and then that causes the problems.
Never made to take up precisely that point. We have most of our literature in this country, there's that much of it, focuses on proximate causes of quality of care. Quality of life within the institution, within the service. It doesn't really tackle the really broad issues accept the causal processes going at high levels and would work through to creating those circumstances and the proximate causes leading to the bad outcomes. Now, I was intrigued by something you said, Josh, one sentence about very recently introducing monitoring of ownership and control. It sounded very much as if you were beginning to move to towards thinking, towards thinking policy service, towards it necessary to have built into the trade and industry policy for the system of government. Create trade and industry policies which actually tackle the fundamentals of market structures and other such things, which work through to create those proximate causes, those immediate, fairly large, enormous causes, or better described causes at the level of the politics going on. Is there any science? Have I did pick up misinterpreted?
Since I got one call, what's happening in the nursing home industry is you've got these very large chains, and they're politically powerful, and they're highly integrated. And I think what's going to dominate what happens in long-term care. For the future is really these integrated care systems. I don't know that they're going to work, and my organization has the multi-million-dollar contract to do the evaluation, but it solves a lot of problems for the states, because they get to have budget certainty, they've got a single organization they can deal with. They don't have to deal with 15,000 nursing homes and another 15,000 home care agencies. So,
these attractions are not lost on discussions of senior and middle ranks, services and sub authorities in this country. That kind of discussion of the merits of kinds of changes.
So, I think the good news with integration is that, individuals don't just come with long-term care needs or medical care needs. They come with a combination. If you can get them to work together, that ought to be better, and you conceivably can get some acute care savings that you could use to finance expanded long-term care services. But
what you would have as a center, central features of trade and industry policy, which would tackle problems of getting the chains to behave more like utilities and principles should behave. I say that I hope to complete inaudibility, because our record of the regulation of public utilities is absolutely atrocious. They're a national scandal, as much a national scandal as our regulation.
What trade and industry policies would you put in place to make the chains act properly?
I think Josh raised the point about political power. And at one point, I was really interested in trying to do some kind of political analysis of lobbying power of nursing homes. And I did actually get to the point of looking at, how much money nursing homes contributed to state-level political races. And, it is actually sufficient. So Josh is absolutely right that it's a power issue. It's about a power of a particular industry, and they've got their money, their livelihood based on this. And so, you know, potentially, if you have an equally powerful opponent, which is the managed care contractor, you know, they're, you know, I think regulatory tools have clearly not been particularly effective. And I agree with Charlene that, everybody, I think, agrees that enforcement is critical. But I also think in terms of, you know, market-based pollution, you know, integration might be helpful.